Welcome back to the Poor Pearls Almanac. This is Andy, and today we're joined by the author of the book Tree Thieves, Lindsay Borgen. This book covers illegal timber harvesting on the West Coast. In this episode, Lindsay explains her initial interest in the subject, which was sparked by a 2012 news story about stolen old-growth cedar. Through a series of interviews and research, she uncovers the complexities of tree poaching and how it's not necessarily just a conversation of bad people doing bad things. This raises really important questions about the roles that economic and cultural disenfranchisement have and how we assign blame and responsibility with ecological issues, and how this might tee up some bigger conversations as climate change accelerates. This is a really fun conversation, and we talk a lot about the interplay between identity and work and environmental ethics, and how this all plays out in this extreme example of illegal timber harvesting on the West Coast. So take a listen, let us know what you think. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us. You released a book last year about illegal timber harvesting on the West Coast. First off, how did you find yourself interested in this subject?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I first came to the topic of tree poaching and really kind of poaching in general in 2012. And that was when a short news story came out on the CBC here about a old growth cedar that had been stolen from a provincial park in British Columbia on the West Coast. And at the time it was, you know, a short news story. I had seen people sharing it online and I was working as a magazine writer and I thought, oh, this might make a really good sort of magazine paper type story. And so I started calling around and doing interviews with people. And then it very quickly ballooned out into this much larger, more complicated story that I really wanted to tell, because people were kind of saying, you know, this is a very sort of obvious, daring crime that surprises people, but it's actually really not surprising in the context of the communities where this happens. And once I started digging into the history and sociology of it, that's where the book came from.
I will say, reading it, what I really did appreciate is that you don't go, or at least you don't present yourself in the book as going in with a certain perspective. And, you know, you meet with these people honestly and try to understand why they're doing what they're doing. When we talk about like illegal harvesting of plants or animals, it's something that's very easily villainized and to an extent justifiably. But that also means those same people are aware of that villainy, or at least that perception of villainy. So for them to do it anyway means that it's a much more complicated question than just saying, these are bad guys doing bad things because they're bad guys. And no, not really. And that's something you talk about a lot in the book.
Yeah. And I think there are a few times in the book where that's laid out very bluntly to me, you know, like poachers, in particular, one timber poacher in Northern California, he very much identified with this sort of Robin Hood-esque elements of what he does. There were also two other poachers who I profiled who actually had quite a nuanced perspective on why they committed this crime. But, you know, I am in going back and kind of going through my thought process for why I approached the story the way I did. I was looking at how people had shared the CBC story link that I just mentioned on Twitter. And, you know, it was a lot of retweets and replies saying, calling people scum, you know, calling people just monsters and killers and all of this. And at the same time that I had seen that, I had been reading a lot of history about like the early forests and kind of how we've come to sort of see and manage conservation lands in this very sort of fenced off enclosed way. And this was all kind of muddling together in my mind. And so, yeah, I appreciate what you said about my approach. I think at first I would have, or I did even see it as, here's my magazine story, bad person does bad thing, police officers and rangers and whoever investigate, here's how they catch them. And it's just not like that. You know, it's all wrapped up in identity and work living on the land or trying to live on the land,
Yeah,
trying to maintain.
there's a certain cultural value to the way that what they're doing and the way they're engaging with it on this very interpersonal way that I think is really displaced in our greater economic system, which doesn't value the inefficiencies that creates in the thoughtfulness of choosing trees and things like that. And that might be being a little bit lenient towards some of these people that are doing it, but I do think that there's this like nuance to it, not just in the traditional way of like, yes, these are people in like in many cases communities that have been functionally abandoned by the greater economic system, but also like the cultural value of and trying to restore some of the cultural value of like having relations with the landscape is messy, especially when it's got these layers of economic disenfranchisement, cultural disenfranchisement.
I mean, especially when you consider logging, although I think hunting and fishing kind of fit within this. But in North America, the push west and the act of logging and the act of building these communities is a huge part of how we see the country, right? And so a lot of people, as you know, in Oric or in towns in Washington State or Oregon, Northern California, they're saying to me, my great, great, great grandfather helped make this country. And now I'm not allowed to do that job. And that might sound very blunt and it is very complicated, but from their perspective, it's we helped clear land and displace people, of course, but we helped with this colonial project, this empire. The cities kind of grew up around it. And through various reasons and measures, we are now vilified for killing trees as opposed to being part of the expansion, which was positive in their family history, right?
Yeah, and I think when we talk about this idea of like illegally harvesting or poaching, it implies that they don't care about the ecologic benefits that ecosystem is providing, and that's not the case. They value it in a very different way in some instances, and I think there's merit in saying that like some of it is still a bit extractive, but I do think it offers a really good linchpin in moving some of these conversations in a really good way, as long as people can come to the table with that understanding.
Right, which in very modern history, that just hasn't been a priority, or for whatever reason, that hasn't happened, right? So when I was talking about tree poachers in Northern California, it was really in the context of the timber wars of the early 1990s. Whether that's historically accurate or not, that is the sort of memory of when things started to be really difficult in that region for a lot of families. And so the Forest Service and the National Park Service, they're still distrusted because of that time. And there's a lot of examples of the government, particularly when Redwoods National Park was first founded and then expanded a decade later, holding community events, not even within small communities, but within local cities nearby, and listening and receiving comments from all sorts of leaders and people that live there, and not doing anything with what was told to them. And there is a lot of deep sort of memory around what that felt like to have a Senate subcommittee come visit your town and you tell them exactly what you're thinking about things that we still deal with now, right? So they were saying, expanding the park, we're not actually fully against that because we understand, but you cannot expect that tourism is going to keep my town alive. You cannot expect that a service economy is going to step in where this where logging might be diminished or leave entirely. And that is on the record and then kind of bound up neatly and put in a library somewhere and not acted on.
Yeah, and that's something that you really drive home in the book is you talk to these people, and a lot of them do infer that they wish that there was a different way they could live, but it doesn't exist, and infrastructure for something doesn't exist. And when they have tried things, it seems like they generally just they're topical. They don't really address any of the root issues, so they eventually flounder and fail.
Yeah, or they
And
come
I
with funding that's tied to a cycle that, that's maybe 5 years long, and they work for 3 of those 5 years, and then that funding doesn't continue anymore, and it hasn't sort of had the foundation to boost up and create its own sort of sustainable economy. So it's all very, like, it often comes from a good place, I think, from, from governments or organizations, but it isn't sustainable.
And I think it fundamentally, at least in the examples you give in the book, none of the issues empower the community to be self-determined or to have any agency in some of those conversations to decide that, yeah, my life, myself or my father may be the last person who did this, but I'm okay with that because I'm choosing to make that decision.
Right.
That seems to be like very clearly lacking.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really great point. And I think, it's interesting when I was doing my interviews for this book, and I really was speaking very widely to all sorts of people. And I think someone had said to me, there was a bit of sort of government funding that had come down from the federal government to kind of help certain people that qualified get by, and that funding was undersubscribed, so people didn't want to take it. And I kept thinking, well, yeah, I don't, a lot of the folks I was speaking to, like, first of all, they would never really, whether I agree with it or not, they wouldn't really see social funding as, or social money as something that they wanted to take, because it was, it came with the stigma of a handout. The responses to this sort of crisis or these issues of deindustrialization, they were never presented on an even playing field. It was always, don't worry, we'll give you something to get through, and not, what do you need? What would you like to see? And that really fosters a lot of anger, and it also prevents a fair number of people from moving forward, because there is still a lot of clinging on. Well, what we need is the mill. What we need is work in the woods, as opposed to allowing the sort of mood to flare and settle. It just flared.
I'm really interested as a writer and researcher about this whole process of working with and getting people to go along with you, basically going along as they do illegal stuff, and kind of how did that process go, and what was it that you did to get them to basically buy into, what the story is more important than my own personal safety, or maybe they just felt fully safe
Oh,
with you.
well, I appreciate the implication. So I should say that I never went out on any sort of poaching mission with anyone. And the cases that I wrote
Well,
about, but I did interview people extensively and sat in their homes and spoke to them very, very consistently. But and the cases that I
there
built,
were some that you went
sorry.
and actually saw the sites that were
Oh,
recently,
yes. Yeah.
poached, and things like that.
Yeah, and those were shockingly close to any sort of public trail. So, I was not going out in the dead of night or anything like that. Some of them were very, very easy to find. Well, they all were very easy to find. I think in general, when it came to the time that I spent with poachers and the broader communities within the town as well. And I've said this before, and I hope it doesn't sound too glib, but I think I was the only person that had approached them to ask about it. And some of these stories were quite—I mean, they were in magazines and they were written about. But I just went up to them and asked. I've lived in rural towns. I grew up in a very rural area. I lived in a rural area until a month ago. And I've recently kind of moved, but anyway, so I knew that showing up was very important. I asked around, so I said, I'm looking for X person, do you think they'd be okay if I went to their house? Yeah, sure. Just go knock on their door. I didn't presume to be invited in anywhere. I just kind of stood on the porch and introduced myself, said what I was writing about, and I had very few people say no. Even when they did say no, they were really kind about it. There wasn't much anger on that front. And so I really think it did come from the fact that Perhaps they had been in a broader way stereotyped as like they won't speak, that they're not going to want to talk to me, or they might have, it might feel a bit scary to go to somebody's property and knock on the door. But I just went and did it because I felt like, well, I felt like, I certainly I wasn't going to not do it, and I also knew that there were some. I think maybe you have some experience in this, but rural areas, people don't like always have the same phone number. They don't always, so I knew that showing up and doing it myself was really important because there's probably no way anyone was going to answer my phone call from an unidentified number if that was even still their phone number.
Yeah,
So,
especially an out of zip code number or
oh
area
yeah,
code.
like there's just so many reasons why a phone and whatever wasn't going to work. So yeah, and I felt like if I showed face that they could see my, see myself and get a little bit of the approach that I bring to things, which is just talking to people. I do approach things with more of a historian's mindset as opposed to a journalistic kind of here's my recorder in your face sort of thing. And I think that was helpful. So all of our interviews started off with hours talking about the town and like family history before we got into the criminal element of
Yeah,
things. So,
that's interesting. There's,
because that was actually my interest, right? I mean, like
yeah.
I have this hook of poaching and why it happens and blah blah blah, but really it very quickly it became this kind of socio-historical thing.
Yeah, the book ended up really being this narrative about like what, how do we deal with these cult, these communities, and I'm saying that kind of haphazardly.
Oh yeah, I don't worry.
But how do we collectively address the fact that we've created communities when we needed materials, resources, this colonial project to expand, and then just not recognize the needs and the autonomy and the care that communities deserve. And the issue of poaching is really just a byproduct of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
And a
I do.
vilified one, I think you're right in saying, in a way. I mean, I don't want to imply that I think like going out and just taking down a redwood or taking down smaller cedars or, out here it's black oak or sorry, black walnut. I don't think that's okay. I also don't, well, anyway, I just can really understand the precedent for it and the need to do it.
Yeah, well, what's the quote? Ask for work if they don't give you work. Take, I'm not gonna be able to remember off the top of my head, but it's
That
basically,
word
if.
take, yeah, and that word take is fascinating to me because I would say to folks, say I was going to a poacher's house, not Danny Garcia, but his uncle. I went to his house and I said, I'm writing this story about tree poaching, and what can you tell me? And he said, we don't poach trees, we take trees. And this is that word is a line through history. I mean, you'll read it in early documents about like poaching from the King's Forest. We took deer. And I just think it's fascinating, even just that linguistic desire to
Yeah,
change
it
it.
speaks to like an empowerment of decision making, and I do think it is very much broadly speaking kind of like a poorer class ethos, and that it's something that I take to heart in a lot of ways because it was part of my childhood of like, what if you can't get it and there are no resources for you, there's no ethical issue with doing what you need so that you can survive, and that ability to survive for another day is superimposes itself over any other like ethical requirements, other like as long as you're not obviously like physically harming anyone or so on, that those caveats, but for the most part.
But and don't you think it's an interesting question then, and this is some pushback I've received as well, is, but are you not harming the tree? Are you not harming the forest? Are you particularly with these folks that were taking cedars from parks and things like that that are supposed to be protected areas. And there are some real thorny questions around how we value human life and the natural world. And obviously we know that it is all very interlinked, but I think a fair number of folks that I spoke with in the Pacific Northwest would tell you that they felt that trees were valued over their own lives.
Yeah.
So
And
that's hard to justify.
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
I think from like an abstract perspective, you could see the art, like the kind of straw man argument for that case of like, well, if there's no trees, then none of us live and you're not more valuable than, you know, all of us collectively. And of course, that's kind of like false and misleading. And I think their concerns are very valid that like if our trees are worth more than us. But again, you know, I want to use another quip. If you're a hammer, you know, everything looks like a nail. And I think for communities that are so specialized in certain skills, of course, they're going to, when they take, it's going to be a very specific way.
Yeah.
And like without the infrastructure to be able to retool, to be more diverse in their skill set, to maybe better utilize the trees, because you do talk a bit about sometimes, because they're going in sometimes at night, and they're hastily taking down these trees and getting them out as soon as possible. There is a lot of waste because of the way they're doing it. And, you know, the collateral damage is significant because, again, the way they're doing it, you talk about like some of the burls that they take out and like that they're not always the most ethical ways to do it. And again, it's because of that context. It's not because they don't care or they can't do those things, but because of this greater infrastructure that kind of limits their capacity.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, this is neither here nor there really, but there is like also this real undercurrent of between poachers of like that guy cuts a burl in a really nasty way. And like, I do really clean cuts that, you know, aren't going to hurt the rest of the tree and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, this is something that that people are thinking about, you know, it's not just, I don't give a crap about a tree and I'm going to take it down. You know, they're able to assess the values of certain woods and the grains in certain woods, because that's really where the financial value is coming from. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It's so complicated, I guess, in that way, but it's also really, I mean, fascinating, right? So yeah, I mean, it might be that there's like tons of duff left behind. So, you know, branches and sawdust in big piles and areas where they've dragged out a log is being completely trampled down. And it does look messy and it does look like a crime. It also grows over so quick. And actually there's a recent case in the UK where two people have been charged now. And I don't know if they've been found guilty or what, but of taking down this huge tree that was known as the Robin Hood tree. Because it was in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, this famous movie. And yeah, it was cut down in the middle of the night. And the site was left a little bit of a mess. And it was an iconic cultural thing. People are incredibly enraged, as they have a right to be. And already there are new trees growing from that site, which is also puts, you know, the words of poachers into reality, which is a lot of them were saying to me, that tree's not dead, that there's new growth coming. It looks bad. It's going to move, you know, it's going to grow. It's going to be grown over. So both are correct.
Were there any stories that maybe were a little bit too hairy to put into the book or not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I tried very hard to keep it to cases that were closed. I would say that without naming them, I did speak to poachers that did not appear in the book. And there were cases that were shared with me of trees being down that I know that have not been, that no one has been charged with that theft. Mm-hmm. Because it's incredibly hard actually to charge somebody with stealing a tree because you need to match the wood in their possession to the stump. So there were poachers that had, you know, had detailed to me trees that they had stolen in places that I know that there were no cases. And those did not make it in because, well, I don't know. I think there's probably an argument. Nope, not really. And I felt that the cases that did make it and that were sealed, everyone was on a level playing field there as well. There were no surprises because everyone had seen the documents that were used to create those cases. So yeah.
It's interesting.
But I suppose there is an argument that I could have put more in, but anyway. It's kind of like the greater good of the story versus kind of how jam-packed with detail you want to get.
Yeah. So, did you come away with any surprising thoughts about what we should be doing differently? What a solution actually looks like? Yeah. If we'll ever see a solution in our lifetime?
I think that there were something that really surprised me was the articulation within the community and amongst poachers that the law enforcement wing of the National Park Service and the Forest Service, that often that those employees were not local. They had not grown up in the community. Nobody knew them. And that community folks had really found that to be very frustrating, that they felt that it impeded communication and understanding. And so there was just a really strong point of view of like, I don't know these people. They don't know me. They don't know my context. They don't know why I might be driving somewhere. Their responsibility is to perhaps the federal government and not to the town outside the boundaries of the park. And that was a really, I think I had perhaps known that a little bit, but to hear people voice it so consistently across contexts, you know, these are people, not just poachers, people that run town businesses, people that run nonprofits in the region, you know, and they're all saying we have an issue with turnover in these agencies and at these parks and what that means for community stability. So I think that was a really important thing for me to hear in particular, just how important it was to the people that live there that maybe they work within the system. Like, what, you know, why are we not being hired? Basically. Yeah. So I thought that was important. A big surprise for me, like just in my own perspective, is I came away with a much more nuanced understanding of the drug crisis in the Pacific Northwest. And actually, I think everywhere, I think methamphetamine use, for instance, is across all sorts of communities. And a lot of people had said to me when I first started, you know, people steal trees because they're meth heads, you know, like that, you know, they're often very blunt, like they'll just be like, well, it's about drugs. And that is true. That's not a lie. A lot of them are users, I guess, for various reasons. And I came away with a different perspective on why that is. And a lot of it is historical. You know, I guess I did not know a ton about the history of how meth was introduced to a lot of communities. And so that was really good for me to learn. The poachers who I interviewed were so generous and open with me about something that I think they might see as being shameful. And it changed the way that I view drug use in those communities and just how kind of messed up it is, how it arrives in the community and how it stays, you know, 20 years, 30 years later.
So, yeah.
And how hard it is to, I mean, I don't have any solutions for that. I mean, it's just, it's something that has taken over rural communities in particular across Canada and the United States, I think, and is really quite a shameful thing that we've allowed to take place. I think the stories would be familiar to anyone who listens to this podcast about how people sort of get into that. I mean, one poacher in particular, this was very much a sort of part of his family life. So many people have heard sort of about the sort of trickle down trauma of drugs and drug use. Two, I would argue three, but I don't have proof, but two of the three poachers that I profile and that I spent much much time with for this book, you know, were or are still regular users of meth. One of them preferred it over his ADHD medication, which is, I think, could be familiar to many, many people to hear something like that. I don't think that actually the meth spurred the poaching. You know, I don't think that he poached trees only to get money for drugs, but I do think it assisted it. And I also think that there's this like very interesting deep history of using amphetamines in the workplace, in industrial workplaces, that at one point was considered a great thing because of the productivity that it enabled and who benefited from that. And when it expanded and intensified and became sort of a backyard poor person, you know, in quotes, drug, and became associated with disgusting stereotypes of the working class, it changed sort of how people react to hearing that someone is using a drug like that. But it was and is a part of his life and his father's life. I think I just now come to it with a bit more sympathy and a bit less of a immediate sort of, you should stop. You know, I think that's a very simplistic point of view that I had at one point in time. And now I think, oof, we've really created a system where it would be unfair of me to tell you not to use at this point.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Go ahead. But I mean, it was also part of the reporting for this in a way that I had to also, I mean, I don't want to really sugarcoat things either. Like I did have to be aware of it, you know, like when you're talking about safety and things like that, it has nothing to do with him as a person. But, you know, I was very aware of like, when am I going to do these interviews? Where are they going to be? Because I don't really want to find myself in a sort of difficult situation to get out of or things like that. So
you wrote this book a year ago. I'm assuming you're working on something now. I don't know if you can talk about that at all.
Yeah, and it actually springs or is intertwined with Tree Thieves in a little bit of a way. So at the end of Tree Thieves, I talk a little bit about community forest management and these sort of I wouldn't even call them alternative now because there are setup systems for this, but you know, the opportunities for communities to manage tracts of land that at one point would have either been privately owned or owned by a federal agency, and the ability to manage that land with different outcomes in mind that are often less strict. And actually part of this that I find quite interesting is that in Scotland, there is a 20-year-old law called the Land Reform Act, which if you read the early parts of Tree Thieves, it kind of brings together the early parts and the end of the book, where I talk about the enclosures movement and clearances of land, of, you know, moving working class people into cities so that land can be managed for the wealthy and by the few. And so this act basically empowers rural communities to buy back land from both government agencies and private landowners, which much of the country is owned by very few, very rich people. And they manage that land for the community good. And so there are no sort of private landowners. And it often facilitates interesting traditional crofting and farming practices and allows for this sort of deeper cultural connection to the land, because it recognizes that some communities, their identity and their culture has been damaged by the sort of land ownership concentration. So anyway, it's kind of about this Land Reform Act. There are some entire islands, for instance, that have bought themselves back from families that have owned them since the 1700s, or, you know, mountains being bought by a community or entire forests. And I think it's quite a radical and sort of inspiring way to look forward to different methods of managing land. And it includes use, which I'm really interested in. And includes it's not just to put things away for pretty views. You know, you've got communities that are raising animals and hunting and fishing in rivers that they were not allowed to for the past 300 years and stuff like that. And in fact, there's a quote from one fellow when his community sort of successfully took back their island And he had previously been charged with poaching deer. And his sort of first quote at this meeting was, "Well, there are deer again. There are deer now." That's just amazing to me. So yeah. I'm writing about community land in that way.
Awesome. When do you think that'll be out?
I have no idea. So if any listeners are interested in, you know, reaching out if they know stories and things like that, please do. But yeah, it's very early stage of exploration right now. So doing lots of interviews and kind of following rabbit holes and all that fun stuff. So
the fun part.
The fun part, yeah.
Yeah, where the options are limitless and it's easy to find
it
stuff
anything.
Still. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Where can, if people want to follow along, see what's going on with your book when it comes out, where can they find you?
I mean, I'm on Instagram. It's my full name is my handle. I still use Twitter marginally. And so my handle for that is L Borgon, but I don't like to encourage people to go on there too much anymore. And yeah, so probably Instagram is the best place. And I have a website as well.
Awesome. I'll say it in the intro, but we haven't actually said the book's name this entire time, but it's
right,
called
yeah.
Tree Thieves, and you can get it anywhere. It's a great book. I really enjoyed reading it. Lindsay, thank you for writing a really interesting book and for coming on to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.